Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
David Finkel, National Enterprise reporter for The Washington Post, is author of the widely acclaimed book, The Good Soldiers, for which he embedded himself with an Army battalion from Fort Riley, Kansas, at the height of the troop surge in 2007. His goal was simply to document the war as experienced by these young Americans, not to draw conclusions about President Bush or whether the war was right or wrong. The book is coming to be seen as a masterpiece and is just out in paperback. Finkel previously won a Pulitzer Prize for explaining U.S. democracy efforts in Yemen. He is now working on a follow-up to The Good Soldiers that documents their sometimes difficult homecomings. David Finkel, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Who were the 216 Rangers and why did you choose to embed with them?
If you think back to 2007, which at this point seems like a long time ago, the war in Iraq had seemed to have reached its lost moment. And this was thought by people not only in the press and in the general public, but by many, many people in the military. In that moment, when the surge was announced, off went a battalion of soldiers out of Fort Riley into East Baghdad. And this was a battalion of 800 soldiers, like the average age 19, most of these guys leaving the country for the first time in their lives, absolutely eager to get in there and to be the difference in the war. Interesting moment to be a writer and a reporter. At that point, great policy books on the war had been done, memoirs were coming out, but there had not been an observed piece of journalism about the far end of policy, about what a soldier goes through. So I decided to go and see.
Just as I think we forget clips like this from President Bush's January 10th, 2007 troop surge speech. The policy debate about the troop surge was at its peak, but he was also saying things like this.
They serve far from their families, who make the quiet sacrifices of lonely holidays and empty chairs at the dinner table. They have watched their comrades give their lives to ensure our liberty. We mourn the loss of every fallen American, and we owe it to them to build a future worthy of their sacrifice.
And you refer to that speech in your book, but I think phrases like that, passages like that, just get used as political footballs by one side or the other as to whether the war is good for the troops or bad for the troops. And you dove in and decided to live with them for a period of time. Where exactly were you and for how long?
Sure. It's funny hearing those words because I remember when he did that speech, I was at home listening and shrugged it off as so much more political conversation, nothing more. But I have to say, when I just heard it, I found myself quite moved now that I've seen what war turned out to be for these young men. It's interesting. And I had the same reaction the other day when Obama was in Atlanta giving a speech to the disabled American veterans, where basically he was saying he's on track. By the end of August, the U.S. will be down to 50,000 mostly advisory troops in Iraq. And when he was saying that, I happened to be out at Fort Riley at a welcome home ceremony for the latest batch of soldiers to be coming out of Iraq. It was some of the guys I had written about in my book. They had redeployed. They were coming home again. And so here they come into a gym filled with hundreds of family members who are crying and cheering and holding up signs and their flags everywhere. And honestly, it was quite moving. But mixed in with these hundreds of people were soldiers I knew quite well from the first deployment during the surge. And look, these are guys with the signature injuries of this war, with severe PTSD, with severe traumatic brain injury. I was standing next to a guy who was having a hard time hearing because in June 2007, he was in an explosion which caused him to bleed out of his ears all day long, and he's still having difficulties. So the fact is, and I'll answer your question about where they were, but I just want to make the point now that as we reach this point of drawing down to 50,000 troops, and many people are thinking the war is about over, Number one, for the soldiers who fought it, the war is anything but over. And number two, if we're trying to assume it is done, even as the war leaves Iraq and moves into America, which it's doing now, the only way to understand what we're facing here in America with the residue of this war is to understand what it was like at its very worst. And these guys in East Baghdad were there at its very worst.
And The Good Soldiers is a magnificent book, but on many pages, a difficult book to read for exactly the reasons that you were just describing. Constant battle, gruesome deaths, good men falling apart. I flagged a short passage here to read where you write about an event near the end of the mission called the Ranger Ball. And do you want me to read this, or should I give this to you and
no,
you read this?
I like your voice so much better.
So you write, Adam Schumann, for instance, who lived just up the street from the hotel where the ball was going to be, would stay home that night. He had flown away from the war in a medical helicopter, and when he came home, he had been loaded up with antidepressant medication and anti-anxiety medication and anti-panic medication and narcotics for back pain and something else to help him stop smoking and something else for the impotence that had developed from all of the medications, until finally his wife mentioned that he was turning into a zombie and their marriage was dying. On his own, he had stopped taking most of the medications after that and only reluctantly continued to see the social worker he'd been assigned to, who had listened to him describe his dreams and had said that bad dreams in returning soldiers were quite normal. The key was to relax, the social worker had said, and so Schumann would try to relax. He would go fishing. He would walk around a golf course and think it might be a good place to work after the Army discharged him. He would grill up some fresh walleye in his backyard where he had planted some rose bushes. But the war seemed to want to continue. On the day of the Ranger Ball, he would cut some roses to bring inside for his wife, and when a thorn pricked his finger, he would think of the firefights. And when he tasted the blood, as he licked it away, he would think of Sergeant Emery. And by the time of the ball, he would decide it would be best to stay home.
Yeah, Adam Schumann was widely acknowledged to be one of the very best soldiers in this battalion of 800. And soon after these guys got there, they were trying to bring a particularly restive area under control. And one guy up on a rooftop, a sniper, got a clean shot into the back of his head. He didn't die, but he was seriously injured. Collapsed on the roof. The firefight continued. They had to somehow get this guy downstairs to be medevaced. And Schumann finally strapped him across his back in kind of a fireman's carry and took him down the steps. And I don't know, I guess it was just the angle of things, but so much of the blood coming out of this one soldier's head kept going into Adam Schumann's mouth. And he spit it away, got the guy out. 6 months later, Adam Schumann, it's October now, Adam Schumann couldn't stop tasting this guy's blood. He was on his third deployment. He had been in country for about 1,000 days, and he couldn't do it anymore. So he was sent home.
Was in the war. The passage that I was reading was
afterwards,
from near the end, where he is, you know, supposed to be at a festive event at that hotel, but he couldn't even go because of all of that stuff.
Exactly.
Is that the essence of the legacy of the war for the 316 Rangers?
For the 216, yeah. For a lot of these guys, absolutely. Not all of them. Some are going about their lives, and if you saw them, you would think they were just fine. I get emails. Now that the book is out, I get emails from a lot of soldiers who you would look at on the street and think they're the toughest, sanest, most perfect guys in the world. And for some reason, in emails, they confess to me about how difficult a time they're still having. Look, Schumann is one of them. I'm with him a lot.
And I understand that. Maybe we should say Adam Schumann is one of the guys you're following for your new book about reentry into civil life,
yeah,
correct?
So I do spend a lot of time with Schumann. And, in fact, he's still a great guy, and he is having just the hardest time imaginable. And it's affecting his wife. It's affecting his friends. It's affecting his children. And it's affecting him. He continues to feel great guilt over not over the great things he did, but the fact that mid-deployment he couldn't do it anymore. He had to go home. And it's not because he lost a leg or an arm or an eye, but he has a psychological injury. And that's a hard thing for a soldier to deal with.
Washington Post correspondent David Finkel, my guest on WNYC, author of the widely acclaimed book, The Good Soldiers, for which he embedded himself with an Army battalion from Fort Riley, Kansas, at the height of the troop surge in 2007. It's now out in paperback. And we can take phone calls for David Finkel. Any Iraq war vets want to call in? You're so welcome. Anyone else, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And let me cycle back a little bit because we never did establish where you were exactly and for how long.
Yes, thanks. I did get off track. Thanks for asking about that. These guys get on buses and then planes and then helicopters, and where they land by the luck of the draw in early 2007 is an area of East Baghdad that turns out to be not at all calm and quite vicious. And whatever you think war white might be, these were kids. They weren't kids, I'm sorry. They were young men. But to them, war was a video game. They were really excited to be there, and they thought they were invincible, that other guys were getting hurt because they were making mistakes, but they were well-trained and they weren't going to make mistakes. And then they had their first death, and then they had their second death, and then the injuries began mounting, and they realized they weren't invincible, and war became what war is, something that absolutely degrades the human spirit and the human soul. And you would see it every day in the actions of these guys. The best way to understand East Baghdad is by the weapon of choice in East Baghdad, which was a type of roadside bomb called an EFP. And can I take a minute to explain it?
Sure.
It stands for explosively formed penetrator. It's a $100 device. It's a tube filled with explosives, and at one end it connects through a wire, pretty much through a wire, to a guy standing in shadows with a trigger in his hand, waiting for the moment to push the trigger. And that moment comes when a convoy of American soldiers reaches a certain point, presses the trigger, the explosives explode. Attached to the other end is a copper disc about the size of a dinner plate. Boom. Off goes this disc at such high velocity, it basically becomes almost liquid, and it burns through whatever is in its way, including the thickest part of a 500-pound door of the very best $200,000 Humvee the U.S. Army had at that point. Through the door, and then it burns what's through inside, which turns out to be American soldiers. Mm. That became the weapon of choice, and as the guys realized that, and they couldn't find them all, and these bombs kept going off, then you saw what war does, the degrading aspect of war on a human being of who might be an eager 19 or 20 or 21-year-old. Mm.
Let's take a phone call. Brian in Manhattan. Brian, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'm totally inspired to hear this conversation. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and as I was explaining to the screener, my PTSD didn't come alive until after 9/11, and then it was like an earthquake to my memories. What I've done in the last few years is I've done a lot of what I would call restoration, and the two key ingredients for me have been spirituality and community. And so I've tried to avail myself and have successfully done so in a few instances with helping Iraq and Afghanistan vets. So I'm so glad to hear you guys having this conversation, because I feel like there's a lot of indifference, which is what I experienced when I came back from Vietnam, a lot of indifference towards the guys today in terms of what they've experienced and gone through.
Brian, thank you very much.
Yeah,
David,
thank you,
I'm
Brian.
Sure you relate to that.
Well, it made me think of a conversation I overheard the other day. I was walking through a VA hospital in central Kansas. I happened to be behind some people, a clinician, who was describing what they do to somebody who was in for a visit, I guess. And she said something like, you know, the things about the guys from Vietnam, they're so expressive. And the guys we're getting from Iraq and Afghanistan, they don't say anything at all. They just go straight to violence and suicide. Now, I don't want to broad brush it. That's, of course, not every returning soldier or Marine or fighter from who's been in these wars.
Why would it be?
But it's a part.
Why would coming home be a different challenge for Americans from the Iraq or Afghanistan wars than it was for soldiers from Vietnam, for whom we've known for so long that it was also so difficult?
Well, maybe it's not different. Maybe it's just it takes some time to be able to talk about what you've been through. Look, I wrote a book on this thing, but when I came home, I sure didn't want to talk about it to anyone. I didn't talk about it to my family. They would ask, and I would just say, you know, I'll read the book sometime. And when the book came out, it's important to stress this, only in terms of the question you're asking. The email I get most often is from a soldier who I don't know, but they write and they say something like, Mr. Finkel, I read your book. I came home. Everyone wanted to know, what was it like? What was it like? And I can't talk about it, and I don't want to talk about it. But now I can give people your book, say, read the thing, and you'll understand what it was like and why I can't talk about it. So in some way, the book is authentic enough to have given voice to perhaps begin a conversation among these guys.
We'll continue in a minute with David Finkel, author of The Good Soldiers. We can take more of your phone calls, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My guest is David Finkel, Washington Post National Enterprise editor, who is also author of the widely acclaimed book, The Good Soldiers, for which he embedded himself with an Army battalion from Fort Riley, Kansas, at the height of the troop surge in 2007. That book is now out in paperback, and David is continuing to follow some of these troops and document what it's like for them to try to return to civilian life. 212-433-WNYC is our phone number, 212-433-9692. Or, of course, you can comment on our webpage, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. And your book includes what was the first public description of the incident, later made more well-known by WikiLeaks, showing a video of an aerial attack by U.S. troops on what turned out to be innocents, including journalists. They mistook a Reuters camera for a weapon, and children. And it included radio chatter among the troops, this incident, some of which sounded cold and bloodthirsty when WikiLeaks released it. This clip has been widely aired, for example.
Light them all up.
Come on, fire.
Hey, Roger. Keep shooting.
WikiLeaks titled their video version Collateral Murder, and this received publicity worldwide. Do you think we should see that attack in a sympathetic light?
Oh, you know, every time I try to talk about this, I get in some trouble because it's such a passionate issue. I was there that day. And so I bring some understanding to it that an edited down video, edited to 17 minutes, put up on a website called collateralmurder.org, and put in context by a brilliant George Orwell quote, my context is a bit different. And I'd like to explain it. Because it involved the battalion I was writing about. What was going on that day was a reaction. It happened in early July 2007. It was a reaction to June 2007 in which soldiers in the battalion I was with were getting killed right and left and injured right and left, particularly in a very tough area. And so this was an operation to kind of clean up that area. And one part of that, it was a huge operation. Several hundred soldiers, maybe 60 or 70 Humvees encircling overhead, a couple of Apaches. And one part of that, they were running gun battles throughout the morning. And then down the street walks a group of men. In the middle of the group are a couple of guys from Reuters, also in the group, because I know this for a fact, were some armed people, one with a RPG launcher, another with an AK-47, because those weapons were found. The bodies were found lying on top of those weapons. Look, nonetheless, what happened, it was a horrible day for everybody, for Iraqis, certainly for the journalists and their families, for the Americans, for the pilots, I imagine, who you just listened to, and for the soldiers who came upon this horrific scene.
In that chapter, you write about one of the soldiers named March, who admitted to feeling happy, so happy, very happy, his quotes, knowing 13 people had been killed, I think that's the right number, after the death of one of his colleagues that had left him so angry. Mm-hmm. Is that what war does to people?
Yeah, don't you think so? I mean, what else does war do? It wasn't so apparent this day, but one of the I'll come back to this. But one of the things I found so moving over there was whether it was an American soldier or an Iraqi being in the worst of circumstances and acting with the most mystifying decency. I mean, because it was so degrading day to day, and there was no reason on some days to be decent, and yet they were on both sides. This was a different kind of day, and it was just awful all the way around. What happened since then is that I did write about it in my book, and then 6 months later, this video appeared, and I've gotten dinged for it pretty good for doing things, being accused of sitting on the video, and also the Washington Post, where I work, was accused of having this video and sitting on it.
Did you have it?
Well, I've never disclosed whether I had the video because and let me explain why. I was reporting a book, and you get information, and you make source agreements to get information, and what you do is you don't violate those agreements. I got a lot of material for this book. It was given to me under certain conditions, and I'm going to honor those agreements. What I can say about what I wrote that chapter from is it was all from unclassified material. That's important to stress. And number two, the main thing is I was there that day. But the Washington Post never, never possessed this video. But because the founder of WikiLeaks suggested the Post did have the video and sat on it, I've been getting some of the most vicious emails of a long career.
What do you think of the soldiers who give things to WikiLeaks? Are they today's Daniel Ellsbergs showing truth to the American people about a controversial war that the Pentagon might be covering up, or not so pure?
You'll hate this answer. One of the things I pride myself on in this book is that it was a book about what the soldiers went through, and it was not a polemic, and I didn't offer my opinion. And I especially want to stick to that with this.
This is about the soldiers, not about the policy.
No, but you're asking me to be a talking head and to mine someone's motives. I don't know what this – if this guy Manning did it, I have no idea what his motives were. And to suggest I do and to talk as if I do, I think would be foolish on my part.
Sharon in Boonton, you're on WNYC with David Finkel, author of The Good Soldiers. Hello.
Hello. I got the call this morning early, it woke me up, that my daughter, who has three small children, whose husband is career military, will be deployed in 2 weeks. And they weren't expecting it for a couple of months, but it's been moved up. And she said she just wasn't mentally prepared for it. She has two best friends where she's living, whose husbands are there. One is on the ground in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. They have small children. And I want people to bear in mind that whether you agree or not with this war, our young adults are there fighting so hard so that we can live the way we live, and their loved ones are back home with very little contact. I happen to know one of the husbands is stuck in an area where he can't go 4 miles to safety because it's so dangerous, and he's been there for weeks. There's a human side, and sometimes my husband, when you see those at the end of some news reports, they'll show the lives and the picture in the life of some young man, very often a man rather than a woman, has been killed in battle, and they give a little story, and you know it's a little memorial, and he'll want to switch the station, and I say no, I grab his hand, I say no, stop. He deserves those 5 minutes of our time. He gave our life so that we can live the way we live. Whether you agree or not with this war, there are still thousands of troops out there doing our work so that we can go about our life the way we do.
Sharon, thank you very much. And David, I'm sure you relate to that.
Well, the soldiers will really relate to it because they were quite aware over there how few people were paying attention to what they were doing, other than occasionally sending a box of goodies and maybe putting a yellow ribbon magnet on the bumper of their car.
And even that gets politicized because when I think it was Jim Lehrer on PBS made the decision to show the names of the dead in the Iraq War in each case on a roll each night or at the end of each week, maybe it was, he got criticized for trying to stir up opposition to the war just by showing the names of the dead.
Well, we shouldn't forget, it's a volunteer army. It's not like these guys are conscripted into service. Nonetheless, if the rate is right, like perhaps 1% of the American population has someone directly, whether it's a son or a father, a husband, whoever it is, directly in this war, that means you can go through a neighborhood, you can knock on 100 doors, and 99 people really have no reason to pay attention. No financial sacrifice. Factories aren't being shut down. It's a war occurring over there, an unpopular war in an unpopular country, so people don't pay attention. But look, the guys are there. They're there right now. They've been in Afghanistan off and on since 2002, Iraq since 2003, and we may be down to 50,000 troops. That's not a small number of people in a country. That's 50,000 people, and it's still a dangerous country.
And your Washington Post colleague Thomas Ricks was on NPR this morning saying it may be more dangerous at this point for people who are considered quote-unquote non-combat advisors than for actual troops because of the targeting of political outlets.
Right. I think Tom makes a good point.
You've said, and you certainly have reinforced it here today, that you set out to write this book with no political agenda, no interest in polemics, no interest in concluding, at least publicly, whether you thought the Iraq War has been right or wrong or worth it or not worth it. But the book includes scenes where the guys are watching General Petraeus and troop surge hearings and watching coverage of anti-war protests like the Cindy Sheehan die-in in Washington. Mm-hmm. What was the range of conclusions that they came to about whether the surge was worth it? What was their reactions at moments like that?
it's a great question. It changed, of course, with circumstances. At the beginning, of course, it was going to work because they were going into it and they were going to be the difference. By the end of it, after, I don't know, something like 15% of the, a little less than 15% of the battalion had been killed or injured and sent home, opinions, of course, changed. And there are some people who, at the end of the deployment, thought that they had made a difference. They had been successful, and to this day they take pride in what they had done. I think it's fair to say most of the soldiers came away from that. It's not that their patriotism was gone, but the patriotism had been supplanted by something much more personal and even a bit cynical. I'm only here because of the guy next to me. The point of the mission seems to have become fuzzy, obscured. Why are we here? It became more and more confusing as the violence that they were trying to tamp down kept increasing, and it kept increasing against them. So if you were to do a survey at the end of the deployment, what do you think of the surge? What do you think of the surge? I think at this point the answer would be most guys have no idea what they accomplished.
David Finkel, author of The Good Soldiers, and you wrote about the day that Petraeus came to visit these troops.
Yeah, there are a couple of days that stand out and about how extreme war turns out to be. And if the intent of this book was to make a reader feel what it's like to be a soldier in war, the day right after the Petraeus hearings is a good enough example. And listeners may remember this day in September 2007 when Petraeus went to Washington to testify about how the surge was doing. It was this huge, huge Washington event. After Petraeus left, the rest of the story is he went back to Baghdad, and soon after arriving in Baghdad, he was doing some battlefield circulation, and he went to see this battalion to see how they were doing. This was a big deal. The guy running the war had come to see this battalion, and the battalion commander, a lieutenant colonel named Ralph Koslerich, very optimistic guy. This was a huge day for him, briefing David Petraeus. And he did that, and he was telling Petraeus about the best thing they had done so far, one of their great initiatives, which was simply to put a platoon of soldiers at a gas station. And by doing that, two-day waits in line for Iraqis waiting for gasoline became 15-minute waits. The skimming that was going on, money being used to build more bombs to be used against soldiers, that evaporated. So this was a big deal. And in describing it, Petraeus interrupted at one point and said, "We know about this. We need to do more of this in Baghdad." And you could just see Khosrich glowing. This was a great day in his life. And Petraeus leaves on to his next thing, and Khosrich is standing outside a couple of hours later, and he's still talking about the greatness of this moment when there was a sound of an explosion. Head swivel around, up comes some black smoke into the air, and it was coming from the fuel station. And the platoon of soldiers was leaving, and one of these EFPs, buried in some trash, went straight through the door of a Humvee and into a soldier named Joshua Reeves, who that morning had just received word from his wife that their first child had just been born. He was waiting to get back and call her. And suddenly it was just a line of people running down to the aid station, Khosrich and a few others, just watching Josh Reeves die in front of their eyes.
So they couldn't take 10 minutes for a little ceremony with General Petraeus coming before reality intruded.
And in the worst, most ironic way, it wasn't just that there was another explosion. It was at the fuel station. It was at a fuel station into a guy who had just become a father. And on, and every day brought to the possibility of this version. This is what these guys experienced. And now that they're home, they're dealing with as the war continues.
Susan in Seacliff, you're on WNYC with David Finkel. Hi, Susan.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask the author two questions, and one is, on a personal level, has he had to seek therapy for any sort of post-traumatic stress that he has as a result of experiencing these things along with the soldiers? And my second question is much more personal for me. I want to know, we are a newly military family.
So it's okay,
and
Susan.
I want to know if we should read the book.
Well,
read it.
Yeah, let me answer the first one first, and it might help answer the second one. I'm fine, and because I got to write, I got to spend 11 months writing the book, which was quite cathartic to make narrative sense of what had happened over there. The reason I wanted to answer that first is the more important thing to stress is that I had advantages over there that soldiers did not have. Number one, I wasn't a fighter. I didn't have to carry a weapon. I was just a guy with a tape recorder and a notebook and a pen, and that's a huge difference. Number two, I could take breaks whenever I wanted to, unlike the soldiers. If it got too much for me, and it did get too much for me after about 6 weeks or so in country, I could either come back to Washington to do some reporting, or the Washington Post had a Baghdad bureau. I could get off this base. I could grab a helicopter to the Green Zone and then take a convoy out to this house where I could sleep late and not worry about rocket attacks and get a little drunk if I wanted to and spend a few days just getting ready to go back into it. The soldiers didn't have those advantages. They didn't get to come home and process what they had been through. They moved on to the next thing, and they only got an 18-day break during a 15-month deployment. That said, when I said at the beginning that one of the things I won't forget is how decently people could act, that does include almost all of these soldiers who every day, knowing that they were about to go once again into a neighborhood seated with bombs aimed at them, would go out. They would huddle up. Some would pray. Some would trade, you know, vulgar lines about what they wanted their last lines to be. They would get in Humvees. Some would sit with one foot in front of another, thinking it's a calculation. If an EFP charge comes in, I'll lose one foot today instead of two. They would tie horseshoes to grills, and out they would go to try to bring about this mission. And the mission, of course, ultimately became take care of the guy next to you. There's no irony in the title. These were good soldiers. The definition of good changed over 15 months, but they were, in fact, good soldiers.
So
if you're a military family now, and I'm sorry it's such a long answer.
It's okay.
But if you're in the military now, you absolutely should read this book. It's because what you'll see beyond these horrible moments are guys in the most extreme circumstances acting in ways that any of us could hope to act. So it's not all grim. There are just great, great lessons in the book as well.
Susan, good luck to you and your loved one who's going to be deployed. Is there anything else you want to say?
Well, yes, I thank you for that answer. As I said, I'm struggling with, would it help us to feel closer to him once he's far away, or would it be the worst and meanest thing that I could do to his mother? I bought her for Christmas the book by the West Point guy that now I can't even say it, which I thought would be helpful to her. And she told me politely it took her a while to read it, but that once she was glad that she did. And this book seems much even closer to the experience that my cousin is going to have, and I just didn't know whether it would be a good thing or maybe too sensitive for her to read
this time,
as opposed to maybe once he's coming home. And he's just finishing training this year. He graduated from Paris Island in January, and then, of course, got married in May. It's a lot.
And you'll have to, Susan, thank you very much, and I guess you'll have to make your own decision, obviously, in your personal case. But your position, David, is clear.
I was just going to say,
people related to people at the front should read this.
It's a tough book. It's an honest book, and I've gotten too many emails from soldiers who were glad they read it to suggest to someone that you shouldn't read it. You should at least start it and see how you're doing.
One last thing. We're just about out of time, but you came back to the title of the book a minute ago, The Good Soldiers, and said you meant good completely unironically. David, on our comments page, and we have a few like this, calls and comments, why the constant glorification of war and our soldiers? What about the millions of innocents, Iraqis, Afghanis, Vietnamese, etc., murdered by our good soldiers?
Yeah, well, this is just one book about one corner of one war. And it just so happens the battalion I was with committed no war crimes. These are young guys. They weren't perfect every day, but most of them tried hard. And in the end, this is not an apology for military conduct in any sense. It's a true, unvarnished story about what soldiers go through and, of course, what Iraqis go through, because there are Iraqi voices in the book as well.
David Finkel from The Washington Post, author of The Good Soldiers, now out in paperback. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thanks very much.